Well, it's the 13th of April 2004 here at MSU Libraries. I'm Peter Lim from the Africana Unit, MSU Libraries, and our visitor today is the well-known independent filmmaker and writer Peter Davis from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Pleasure to be here.
Peter has just given a talk to the African Studies Centre about his experiences in making documentaries around the issue of apartheid for 30 years, looking at South Africa. And before that, he came to us from that other place down the road, the University of Michigan. And he's on his way tomorrow to Indiana University, where his own film archives have been deposited. So with MSU's great involvement in Africa over the decades and with Peter Davis's enormous contribution to film on Africa, especially Southern Africa, we hope that this interview can record some of these connections and some of this interesting work that's been done. So perhaps, Peter, we can start with a brief biographical note. You were born in...
I was born in East End of London, in Bethnal Green, so I'm a Cockney by birth. And I grew up in England, spent the Second World War partly in London. Family moved out of London because of the Blitz into the suburbs, essentially. And spent my high school years there. I got a scholarship to Oxford and studied English literature. After that, I really started my first job was really as a teacher in an Italian school. So I spent about a year in Italy. And returned to the UK, did some more supply teaching, but then I really wanted to get into film production. And I think, although I did a little work as from the very, very, very bottom rungs of filmmaking in those days, and it was an extremely hierarchical system, I started off as an apprentice, not even an assistant, apprentice assistant editor. But I moved to Sweden, and after a year or so, I got work with Swedish Television, and that was when I started working as a full editor, became independent, started making independent films while in Sweden.
Would this have been the 60s?
This would be in the 60s now we're talking about, yeah.
Molto bene. So the Italian connection, is that one of the reasons, or was there an Italian cinematographic influence on you, you know, vis-a-vis Fellini, Pasolini, Antonioni, those sort of people?
Oh, well, I think you're talking about differently because I was always in documentary pretty much.
Yeah.
But I should say, if we're talking about cinema, that growing up in England at that time, we were really a multicultural. We looked towards Europe for our culture as well as, of course, English culture itself. So we were aware of everything that was going on in the continent and saw it easily in theatres in Britain now. Unfortunately, I think it may still be the case in Britain, but certainly in North America it's getting harder and harder to see other cultures reflected in cinema.
The Swedish connection is also another interesting one, which I didn't realise. And was there a link there to Africa at all from Sweden, given that the Nordic countries were so involved in the solidarity movement with peoples fighting against colonialism and apartheid?
Yeah, no, not really. Not in those days, in the 60s. I think there was an awareness of apartheid, much as there was an awareness of apartheid in the UK, but nothing that specifically linked me to Africa.
How then did the interest in Africa come about?
Well, I came to the United States in the late 60s. I actually came to work with a friend of mine who'd been in Sweden at the same time as me. He came home to the United States and offered me some work. So I came here and essentially I settled in New York State, lived there for many years. And it was from there that I was working at that time as an independent cameraman and cameraman director. I would shoot, direct, edit projects, documentaries, and I got on to Africa first through CARE, the American NGO, and I went to Africa as a cameraman recording a number of projects that they had at that time. And I did, if my memory serves me correctly, I did about 12 different African countries in 30 days, a whirlwind introduction to Africa. But
what were some of those countries, by the way?
Oh, gosh, I started in on the West Coast and travelled down, let me see.
On Senegal?
I did Senegal, I did Sierra Leone, I did Nigeria, I use the word did, of course, very loosely. But and then I went down to Southern Africa, Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, and then I went up to, let me see, we didn't do anything in Mozambique, but I went to Kenya afterwards. No, Zambia, yep, certainly did Zambia and Kenya. And I've left out a few. I've forgotten.
It's an amazing grand tour. Yeah. And what remains of those early exploits? I mean, you mentioned your work in New York State and then the whistle-stop tour of South Africa. Mm. Are any of those films that you made for CARE still available, or do you remember anything about these productions?
Right. Essentially, they would have been fundraising tools for CARE. I have one of them, which is called it was a mohair project in Lesotho. It was coverage of a mohair project in Lesotho, which we cut into, I think, about a 10-minute film. So that I have a copy of that. The other reports from the other places, I don't remember anything that would have been long, but they would have been used as public service clips to fundraise for CARE. And they're certainly extant in CARE's archives.
And so this was in the early 70s?
By now we're coming up to the 70s, yes. Yeah.
And was this a single visit, this one when you visited 12 countries? Or,
yes.
When did you next come back to Africa?
Well, then I came back the year after that and did a project for CBS 60 Minutes on sex and gambling in Swaziland. And this I gave it the title of Hello from Swaziland. It was essentially a report on Swaziland as the area where white South Africans could freely sin in a way that they couldn't in the Republic itself, because both gambling and interracial sex were forbidden in South Africa. And
what was the fate of that production?
Well, it was aired on 60 Minutes, but I kept my name off the film because I didn't want to be associated with anything that was obviously anti-apartheid, since I'd determined that I wanted to go back and do a documentary about apartheid. And that I did in the remaining years of the 70s. I did two documentaries there, one called White Lager, which is a history of Afrikaner nationalism, followed by Generations of Resistance, which was a history of black resistance to white rule in South Africa.
You'll come to them in a minute, but I'm interested in the Swazi connection. I used to live with a Swazi activist, and another friend, a South African friend, was in Mkhonto Wesizwe in Swaziland and was nearly assassinated there, so I've always had an interest in the country. And on your short visit there, what were your other impressions, besides making this film about apartheid's other side, so to speak? What did you think about Swaziland? And
well, I think generally we didn't dig deeply into Swazi society. So I can only give you impressions. I had quite a favourable impression of it. A very, very, certainly very beautiful and varied country at that time, but I'm sure it's gone downhill since then because of the AIDS tragedy that's hit Southern Africa. But you mentioned your friend in Swaziland. When I was doing Generations of Resistance, we actually filmed a group of students who had fled after the 1976 Soweto uprising, and that group was attacked by a killing squad from South Africa a year or so after we shot them, and I think most of them were killed.
Mm. And you mentioned the Soweto uprising. Today in your talk you related some interesting stories about your work interviewing Winnie Mandela. I wonder if you could elaborate on how that came about. You've mentioned the film on the White Lager on African nationalism, on Africana nationalism, and also the subsequent filming of Generations of Resistance, so we might come back to that in a minute. But perhaps to keep momentum, you could say something about Soweto and Winnie and how you came to decide to make a film about the Mandelas.
Okay. it's hard to grasp now, but in the early to mid 80s, Nelson Mandela, who'd by then been in jail since the early 60s, so he'd been in jail 20 years by then, I think, was in many ways a person who was disregarded by political elements in the West, and most important being Margaret Thatcher and, of course, Ronald Reagan by that time, who had written off Nelson Mandela as someone who was of no importance whatsoever. At best, I think he was considered a terrorist by Margaret Thatcher, a communist sympathizer, if not a covert communist himself, by Ronald Reagan. So it was my intention to reawaken the world to the importance of Nelson Mandela, and I had the idea of doing a film about the very effective political partnership that Winnie and Nelson constituted at that time, with Nelson being essentially a voiceless icon in prison who had very little contact with the outside world other than through Winnie Mandela, and Winnie's a tremendously courageous stand as his representative and as his voice in South Africa, where she was under constant harassment by the authorities and sentenced to jail terms on a number of occasions. So I wanted to do a documentary about, as I said, this political duo. But by that time, I was persona non grata in South Africa and had to go back illegally, which I did by going through the so-called independent homeland, the Bantustan, that the South African government had set up in the Transkei. And with a great deal of difficulty, we did manage to contact Winnie and reach her in Brandfort, which was in the Orange Free State. That's where she was in exile. And with a great deal of luck, we got to her, managed to do an interview despite a visit outside the house, but not in the house, by the special branch of the South African secret police. And did what I think was a very, very useful, good interview about Winnie and her life, which we eventually brought back and edited into a documentary, which I called Winnie Mandela Under Apartheid. And then I later did a documentary because I felt that Nelson, by his absence, was somewhat missing from that particular film. So I did another one just on Nelson, which I called Remember Mandela. And that was shown. I think it was its first screening. It was a film I had to finance myself. But it saw its first screening at the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. I think the year was 1988, if I remember correctly.
It's quite fascinating, and I just had a curious idea. And if someone asked you to make a film about the life of Winnie Mandela today,
yes,
how you would go about doing that, and whether you would change your... Obviously, the times have changed, but
yeah.
I wonder if that would... how you would approach such a task.
Yeah, I don't think it's anything I would do lightly. There's been, for me, a pretty dramatic change since the ending of apartheid. During the period that I was doing the anti-apartheid films, it was part of the anti-apartheid movement, essentially done by people like me outside the country, because the people who had the most right to do it were the people who were inside the country, had no access to either the tools or the distribution potential that we had. In other words, we were doing these anti-apartheid films by proxy. They should have been done by black South Africans, principally themselves. And with the change of government in South Africa, that and even before that, that became a possibility. The possibility of political speech exercised through film, exercised through video, then became a reality, and of course it's their purview to do that. They should be doing that, and they are doing it to the degree that they can, with the limitations on financing that all documentary filmmakers are under. So, did that answer your question, Peter?
We might come back to that question later of the problems of independent filmmakers in South Africa and elsewhere in the world a little later. But I'd like to come back briefly to your very early films, The White Lager and Generations of Resistance. Interesting combination of Africana and African nationalism. And I remember distinctly the two films when I was prominent in the anti-apartheid movement in Australia from the late 70s. And Generations of Resistance was always a very useful and effective educational tool. So I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the origins of these two films and their effect, or the inspiration for doing it, and how you actually managed to pull it off, given the tight censorship and repressive nature of South Africa at that time.
I saw the struggle for South Africa as essentially a struggle between these two forms of nationalism. On the one hand, a nationalism forged in many ways against adversity by the Afrikaner people within South Africa and against colonial Britain at that time, but the forging of a sense of a people, a white African people, isolated on the South African continent, and against them the growing force of African nationalism, in the sense that Africans themselves were not simply disparate, even tribal ethnic identities, but they were becoming, as the Afrikaners themselves became, a people through adversity, how Africans were becoming one people, a South African people, through their struggle against adversity in South Africa, against white domination. And oddly enough, if I can make a leap, we, I think, see the same kind of force at work in Iraq at the present time, which seems to be forging as we speak now, during the last weeks, forging an Iraqi identity, a national Iraqi identity, against the common threat of American invasion.
Yes, that's an interesting connection. When you went to South Africa to work on the White Lager, what was the response of Afrikaner people? And how did that all work out, these attempts to spin together this tale of Afrikaner nationalism? Did you run into any hurdles along the way? And maybe you could just say a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I had always conceived of doing Afrikaner nationalism first, because I knew it was something that Afrikaners were proud of. So I felt that I should do that first, and then after that, the more difficult, in many ways, project of African nationalism. So I approached the South African authorities, the people who had to give permission, because certainly the project would be examined by them before we could get visas to go and film there. And they were quite happy about the subject. The team, which consisted of myself and two other men, went to South Africa, and we started filming. But at a certain point, we obviously did something that the South African authorities were not happy with, and we were arrested in the Transkei. We happened to be in the Transkei at the time of our arrest. And oddly enough, there was no white jail in the Transkei, which was a Bantustan. So they had to take us to the nearest white jail, which was some hours drive away in East London. And there we were put into the white jail, and had to stay there until they found out from Pretoria, which took an unconscionably long time, what they should do with us. And eventually they served us with a deportation order. Now, we were very lucky in that they did not confiscate our film, part of which we had with us in the trunk of the car. So we were able to eventually get out of South Africa with all the film that we had shot up to that point, which was certainly enough for us to be able to do the film. But then I was persona non grata after that, and only through illicit means was I able to get back into South Africa. And that was essentially by using, on the one hand, territory of Lesotho, and on the other, the supposedly independent state of the Transkei, to smuggle myself back into South Africa to work on Generations of Resistance. But that worked. That was something that was feasible.
So with the Afrikaners that you interviewed, did you detect divisions in the chinks in the armour of this monolith? And did you, for instance, did you situate any of this around, if you like, emblems or architecture, symbols of Afrikanerdom, like the Voortrekker Monument and things like this? I mean,
yes, so that was the basis of my argument, the Voortrekker Monument as an icon, but the central image to me seemed to be that of the covered wagon, and beyond that, the circle of covered wagons, just as in the United States, this is a familiar image, the circle of covered wagons of a group of peace-loving but determined whites who had to fight off marauding in North America, marauding Indians, and in South Africa, marauding Africans, savage Africans. And that was the image that I felt the central myth governing the sense of the Afrikaner in South Africa, that the Afrikaners positioned themselves as a people constantly under threat against an overwhelming black horde, and they had to be eternally vigilant, eternally armed, because they could be overwhelmed at any time by the black savages. And it seemed to me, at the end of the film, I visited Rand Afrikaans University, and that struck me as being like a fortress, or even beyond that, a prison. And it seemed to me that if you isolate yourself in a circle of covered wagons, then you have no access to the outside world, and that you have in fact created your own prison.
Yes, there's some amazing images that you're conjuring up here, and having been to some of those places, including Rand Afrikaans University and UNISA and the Voortrekker Monument, they are these very gargantuan sort of structures that have sometimes been compared to the Mussolini period in Italy with the ice cream cake and other large structures in Rome and other places. So it's an interesting visual things here from the filmmaker's perspective, I think. But maybe we can move on to the Generations of Resistance and African nationalism, and And I wondered how you put this together. I mean, I think it's an excellent documentary, and from what I've heard, you did recordings or filmings in different parts of the world. So I wonder if you could just mention how you put it all together and the sort of problems you had, and how did you manage to let the Africans speak, if so to say. You've already mentioned that Nelson Mandela was in incarceration, so perhaps you could tell us how you put this all together.
Yes, the fact was that at that time the ANC and the other anti-apartheid movements, militant movements, had been forced into exile by the state of emergency of 1960, after the proclamation of state of emergency of 1960. These became banned organizations and could not exist above ground in South Africa. So the headquarters became headquarters in exile, in the case of the ANC in Zambia, and in the case of the PAC in Tanzania. With, of course, very important offices in Europe and especially in UK. So those were the areas that we visited primarily. We did have also a crew working for us inside South Africa to give us additional material. Those are places we visited. When we went to Lusaka, it was a little odd, although we had already gone through London and seen the ANC in London, and when we got to Lusaka, they were not completely trusting of us. I'm sure that was quite wise, and they wouldn't let us film inside their headquarter area.
I understand this because I was there too in the 80s, and my contact was down. John and Ketameng was down with malaria, and they were quite suspicious of me. And until I got inside that compound,
yes.
Go on.
Right, so they wouldn't let us, in fact, film in the compound, although, I mean, we did interviews in the offices there, but we could not establish the compound, as it were. And in fact, that was quite wise, because the compound was bombed a few years after that. But then we had good interviews with people there. Then we moved on to the PAC, because the PAC was inactive, and in many ways, I think it's fair to say, more effective inside South Africa in many ways than the ANC was about. Certainly in militancy, in the number of people that they managed to infiltrate into South Africa, I think, you might want to correct me on this, but I had the impression they were more effective at that time. Anyway, we went to visit them, we went to their headquarters, and...
Do you remember who you interviewed from the PAC? It would have been...
It'll probably come to me, but I can't think of names right offhand now. I'm sorry.
How did you manage to juggle the intense rivalry between the ANC and PAC?
Well, we didn't go into it. That's
why. That's wise, I think.
Right. I mean, that was not my. I wasn't there to create division or to highlight divisions in the anti-apartheid movement. But they, oddly enough, received us with open arms. They took us to a training camp, and we spent a day in the training camp filming freely, filming people who were being trained as guerrillas. And I was so struck by this, but I felt I couldn't use any of that footage that would reveal to anyone's face. So I just used rather general shots from the PAC camp. So that footage is part of my archive in Indiana, and something that should be brought out and at this point can be shown.
So did you manage to get back inside South Africa to make?
I got back very briefly at that time via Lesotho. And by an odd quirk, we were in Botswana, tried to cross over from Botswana into South Africa and couldn't cross the border because my name was on the blacklist. But we did happen to run into the American ambassador to Botswana, Swaziland, and Lesotho. And he was en route himself. He was flying from Botswana to Lesotho, a hop over the South African Republic, and he offered to give us a lift in the plane.
It was very kind of him. Did he have an inkling of what you were doing, and would it have mattered, I wonder?
I'm not sure how much we told him about it, but he was quite affable. We might have been on a golfing trip as far as he was concerned. But he was very, no. There's no doubt that he was his feelings were against the apartheid regime, because we did talk at that level, and I wouldn't want to say that he was totally unaware of what we were doing. But it was a very generous gesture, and we at one point drove through Lesotho and into the Transkei, which seemed to me to make penetration in South Africa itself a possibility. And when we did the Mandela Project, we did go that way. We went through the Transkei into South Africa proper.
So what did you actually film? Did you do any, besides the later interview with Winnie Mandela, when you went into the Transkei, did you just use it to take shots of the countryside, or did you also do some sort of so-called underground interviews?
Oh, no, certainly did interview. We were very much concerned, first of all, to establish the society from which Mandela came, spoke to his relatives, and somewhat astonishes me. No one else had bothered to do that before, to look at Mandela's roots, which were firm and in African rural society. And I think that's been his strength, the kind of sense of responsibility that was instilled into him from earliest times, and which he never betrayed.
It's very interesting, because through the 90s we've had a league of Mandela films, some of them very good, some of them focusing on his own life, and some of them focusing on the views of his comrades. And those films have sort of picked up where you started and gone into his roots. So what do you think about, I'm sure you've seen some of these
films. I don't necessarily see
some of them, though.
No, I don't think I've seen any of them. I may have done, but I saw I may have seen some things at the time I was making Mandela, but afterwards I sort of feel that, okay, I've made my statement, and I've moved on to other things, and I don't.
Well,
really
we've got some of those here in this particular part of the library here, so perhaps I'll check some out, and we can watch them, sections of them, tonight.
Levin, you had asked about other interviews.
Yes, interviews. Yes.
We did. Come across people, because we were looking for them in the Transkei. My contact for the Transkei was a man called Fikile Bam, who had spent several years in jail with Nelson Mandela, a lawyer himself, a wonderful man. And I actually stayed at his house when I was in the Transkei, and he himself was not there at the time. He had a law practice in outside the Transkei. Well, it may have been in East London. Anyway, I was staying in his home, and we had contacts with ANC members. Now, the ANC was itself in semi-covert in the Transkei, because it was not something that the Transkeian authorities regarded with sympathy. But I remember a wonderful interview I had with a young man, a man still young, relatively young, who had been arrested and charged with sabotage, it may have been. And he told me that when he heard his sentence, which, as I recall, was 8 years, he heard that he's been sentenced to 8 years on Robben Island. He said, I felt happy, because I was going to meet Nelson Mandela. And then he said he got to Robben Island, and Nelson Mandela was in seclusion, and he could see him at a distance, but never had any contact with him until the day he was going to be released, the day before he was going to be released. And then he was smuggled in to see Mandela, and Mandela said to him, yes, when you go out you will do this and this and this and this. And that was his sole contact with Mandela, but obviously that was the way that Mandela was able to actively organize from within the prison, by the flow of inmates in and out of Robben Island.
it's amazing territory there in the Eastern Cape, the rolling hills, and one moves further west to the area around Fort Hare and Alice, and of course not so different going back across the border the other way into Natal, what's now known as KwaZulu-Natal. And another interesting story that I've heard you tell is this story of Siliwa the Zulu, which is very much situated in the midst, if you like, of Zulu culture. And I think this would be an interesting thing for you to tell the listeners about, how you came about discovering this film and what you think about it, and what is its sort of, if you like, its significance in cinema.
Together with my associate at that time, they're now talking about the late 80s, second part of the 80s, Dan Wiesenfeld and I embarked on a project which would examine the image of South Africa in cinema. That is to say, the image, the fictional image of Africa that was probably the greatest influence on the minds of people regarding not just South Africa but the whole of Africa, and which overwhelmed, really astonishingly overwhelmed all other images that they might see from Africa, whether it was starving children or wars and strife and so on in Africa. The Hollywood image always dominates, and people think that that's what Africa is. Savage Africa, the Tarzan fiction of Africa. So we decided to do a film, a documentary, which later evolved as for me into a book, which we called In Darkest Hollywood, of course, playing on In Darkest Africa. And in the course of that, we did the film was in two parts. One part leading up to the dividing line of the Sharpeville massacre in 1960, and the political changes that happened after that. And in many ways, in retrospect, we can say that 1960 marked the point at which apartheid, the inevitable demise of apartheid, came from that date. Now we had intended to, especially myself, had intended to do a third part to that, which would deal with the image of the Zulu, and on the basis of what to me is a fact that the only in quotes tribe that almost everyone can name from Africa is that of the Zulu, because it's been dominant in fiction and in films. So I wanted to do a study of the image of the Zulu in cinema, and we never got any money to do that, so it still remains an idea. But in the course of that, we looked at representations of Zulu in cinema, and one that I found fascinating, which was in the archives in Pretoria, it was a film called Siliwa the Zulu, which was made by an Italian film crew together with anthropologists in 1927. And among its many remarkable aspects is that it's almost certainly the first all-black feature film to be made in Africa south of the Sahara.
What you mean, all back by African actors?
Exactly, African actors.
And this was in great contrast, say, to D.W. Griffith's portrayal of using white actors.
Right, yeah, in blackface.
Blackface
in the earlier film.
Birth of a Nation and other sort of films.
Yeah.
So how did you find this? It was just lying around.
It was in the archives in Pretoria. I'm not sure, made in 1927, I have no idea when it was deposited, and they had no record of that either, or who deposited it, when deposited, but there it was, so we looked at it, and from my point of view, quite exciting. But I did a rather cursory review of it in my book In Darkest Hollywood as part of the section dealing with the Zulu image, but I continued research onto both the film and the people involved in the making of it. A man called Gatti, Attilio Gatti, the filmmaker, was an adventurer, self-promoter, filmmaker who was actually active in Africa, mostly in Central Africa, for the next 40 years of his life, and produced a substantial number of films, which I'm trying to unearth at the moment with not great success. He probably made dozens of films. I've only been able to locate three or four of them so far, although I have some clues as to where they might be. And on the other hand, I followed the work of Lidio Cipriani, who was the anthropologist that went along with the film crew, and managed to track down a very, very important cache of photographs that he had taken during their five-month stay there, which is almost certainly, I haven't seen anything to compare with it, almost certainly the most comprehensive collection of photographs of Zulu life, culture, portraits from that time. I mean, immensely valuable collection and very, very fine photographs as well. And this is the area in which I'm working at the moment.
It sounds very much like those photographs perhaps should be shared by the repository in Florence, where I believe they are, perhaps with the Campbell collections in Durban, which is the other great collection, I guess, of early Zulu photographs. But I think there's also an Ethiopian connection there with Cipriani.
Because Cipriani was active, excuse me, in other parts of Africa. The Zulu part of his collection is only a small part of the total collection, which is a very rough estimate to be about 20,000 photographs. So and many of those he took in Ethiopia are around the time of the Italian invasion of that country, and certainly what he wrote was in many ways a justification intended when he published, intended as a justification for that invasion and for white hegemony in the whole of Africa.
Yes, it's a very interesting area, and of course MSU, Michigan State University, has had a long history of involvement with Ethiopian studies, and that collection would be of great interest to our scholars, I'm sure, and other MSU faculty such as David Wiley, the director of the African Studies Centre, and Ken Harrow in English, done a lot of work on African cinema over the years. Thinking of this connection between cinema in Africa and in other parts of the world, such as the United States, I'm reminded of your book In Darkest Hollywood, where you mention D.W. Griffith, and I think his earliest film is called The Heart of the Zulu, and then of course there's Birth of a Nation. So I'm wondering, when you were talking about Silwa the Zulu, and having seen the film, I know the rough plot, and reading your, I haven't seen The Heart of the Zulu, but it seems to me that both of them have this, these sort of themes of the tradition and the tension in tradition versus modernity, if you like, the problem. I know in Silwa the Zulu there's this scene where the so-called witch doctor steals away the young maiden and is recovered, and apparently in The Heart of the Zulu there's this confrontation between the members of the village and the chief or something like this. So I'm wondering if you could maybe say a little bit about this early cinema, also saying a little bit about perhaps the indirect influence of Griffiths and his very racially prejudiced film Birth of the Nation, which of course was a very significant film in the development of cinematography, how these influences might have been felt in South Africa, and also perhaps you've already talked about Hollywood, but perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit more as well.
Yes, in looking at the image of the African, I finally came to divide it into two stereotypes, one being the savage other, that is to say, the tribal, primitive, African from darkest Africa, a threat to the white man, constantly a threat to the white man, and the faithful servant, that is to say, the African who serves a white master, and is mostly in the background, but when he or she comes into the foreground, usually he, very few females have any dominant roles at all, they do so as an adjunct to the white man and to, of course, increase the white man's stature in some way. And it's astonishing how, really, I can say without a single exception, they all fit into that mould. The odd thing about the D.W. Griffith film on the Zulu, which dates from 1908, is that, of course, there are primitive savage Africans there, but the Zulu chief turns against his own kind. Now, that, of course, is the role of the servant, but in so doing he becomes a noble figure in a way that was not possible with the birth of a nation. Okay, so it was okay for that to happen in Africa, but it could not happen in the United States. There were no noble savages in the United States, Sitivar the Zulu has a few oddities, and the first is that it has no white characters, so there's no one to play off the blacks against. They stand there alone as themselves, and again, to a large degree, the tribal is primitive because they go against the hero Sitivar. At the same time, there is a sensitivity, whether it comes from Cipriani or the fact that these were Italians, they weren't white South Africans who were dealing with this subject. In fact, white South Africans could not have touched this subject. There's a sensitivity towards the black characters there that you don't find in South African films, or indeed most films about Africa. Did that cover your question?
The other part of the question, if you wanted to just touch on it, was the indirect influence of Birth of the Nation itself, whether one can draw that connection.
Yeah, I think you can. The Birth of a Nation just preceded a film called Voortrekkers, which is in many ways similar to Birth of a Nation, in that it deals with the forging of an identity, a white identity in Africa, as opposed to the southern identity in the United States. And I think that I have no doubt in my mind that Voortrekkers was influenced by Birth of a Nation, which was enormously successful internationally. And it was a bid on the part of the South African filmmakers to make a film at once on the level, same level as Birth of a Nation, but also there were political undertones from that time, because it was made in the middle of the First World War, and it was intended to raise the martial spirits of young white South Africans.
That leads me on to another of your contributions, in my opinion a very important one, and that's been your resuscitation of historic films. And one of, besides Sitivar the Zulu, another interesting one I think is the one that has Paul Robeson as a contributor, Africa Sings, and this whole business that you're doing of drawing attention to these forgotten films and preserving them with new prints, I think, is a very important one. I think Africa Sings is fascinating, not just for the role of Paul Robeson, where he introduces and sings. I think it was probably the mid-30s or thereabouts. But this is a film that also shows the Great Depression in South Africa, and it juxtaposes the white manual workers in the Depression years with the repression of blacks in Durban and other parts of the country, including the diamond mines. So one sees poor whites, one sees working class blacks, and it is a very interesting juxtaposition of these themes. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about your salvage work, if you like, your work towards the preservation, and how you feel, how successful has been this endeavour of yours to bring to light these early films? Because I think, as a historian, I see that they have enormous value. I showed sections of Africa Sings in my South African history class last year, and I think the students found it very interesting. So behind this, of course, is this whole question of preservation of film, maybe the digitisation of old prints, and obviously you found a lot of stuff, not just on South Africa, but on Zimbabwe and maybe Zambia and other places. So maybe you could just speak a little bit about these sort of themes of that I've mentioned.
Yeah, I think as I've become, producing independent documentary has become harder and harder, much more competitive, many more filmmakers chasing much smaller sums of money, that this has offered me, I am interested, I did become very interested in South African film history anyway, but it offers me a way of dealing with the subject without having to confront the problem of looking for funding sources, which is soul destroying. And I feel that I can do this work, do this research, and where appropriate, record it myself on video with a view to turning that into a documentary eventually along the lines of In Darkest Hollywood, that is, examination of cinema through documentary. But it seems to me that, especially in South Africa, virtually everything that was made about or in South Africa exists within a political and social context, and that is imminently worthy of examination. However slight it seems to be, nevertheless it still can be analysed, deconstructed, mined for an enormous amount of information which maybe doesn't seem to be there on the surface, but once you begin to dig, you find tremendously interesting things. As well as Silivar, at the moment I'm working on a manuscript that Lionel Rogerson left behind. Have I mentioned this to you, Peter? I'm not sure. When he was making Come Back Africa, which is probably the most important anti-apartheid film. There were many anti-apartheid films, but it's one of the earliest and one of the most forceful and one of the most useful anti-apartheid tours. It was made by Lionel Rogerson in 1957-58 in South Africa. And while he was making the film, he was keeping notes, and he intended, obviously, to publish a book, but he never did. And when he died in 2000, his sons found the manuscript, and they passed it on to me to edit and prepare for publication. It's going to be published in South Africa at the end of this year. But in the course of that, although I had already dealt with the subject, Come Back Africa, in Darkest Hollywood, this brought up names that I recognised, names I didn't know, so I began to dig a lot deeper, and I found alive and well one of the cameramen on the film, who's an Israeli, and who himself became a prominent figure in the Israeli cinema. And almost as interestingly, I came across a woman whose name is Myrtle Berman, and I interviewed her last year. She was a left-wing South African, and she played the role of the shrewish housewife, a housewife who screams at a black houseboy for his incompetence in the kitchen. And of course, she herself was a liberal, even more than liberal, and an activist left winger. And I tracked her down, and she had gone into exile, she told me, because she'd been involved in sabotage. Things got too hot, and she'd had to leave South Africa and spent the rest of the years up to the mid-90s in exile in the UK, working on anti-apartheid matters, and finally returned. And she was just fantastic, just an amazing woman. So it was a privilege to meet her, but also to have a taste of the kind of people that Rogerson had been involved in at that time.
And, I mean, another aspect here of your work has been the recovery of what we could loosely term propaganda films from Rhodesia and South Africa. And, of course, this is another whole genre in a way. But it's grist to the mill of the historian again. So, again, I think this is an important role that you're playing in helping to preserve these films, making new prints. What did you find about, I mean, in Zimbabwe? Did it extend to Zambia? What can you tell us about Zimbabwean film? And
the Zimbabweans had, I can't say what the present situation is, but the Zimbabweans had a good, well cataloged, completely cataloged, unlike the Pretoria archives, completely cataloged collection of their material, and they had received a grant from Sony Corporation to put this archive in order. So it was there, it was running, it was completely catalogued and accessible. Now, that's probably the best example of what is happening outside South Africa. The Pretoria archives are much undervalued, drastically underfunded, but they're certainly better off than the archives in Mozambique or Angola or anywhere else we can mention, where there will be no idea, no conception of the value of historical film material on the part of the authorities, the part of the people who would necessarily have to take responsibility and commit funding for the conservation of these materials. So it's really a drastic situation in Africa, and I'm just talking about the areas that I have some knowledge of. And there's a whole of the Congo, I think, is probably well preserved because of the Belgian interest in their colonial archives, but beyond that, I think that everything is at hazard.
Perhaps we could conclude by just examining some of the problems of independent filmmaking today, and problems of distribution. You've touched on finance. Recently, you wrote an excellent review of a new book, To Change Reels, by Balseiro, where you drew attention to the problems even of countries such as France in surviving in the face of the Hollywood juggernaut. So I wonder what your views are on the future of independent filmmaking in this globalised world.
Well, I think it's a tremendous problem. I was in Sitenge, which is the South African film market, at the end of last year, and what happens there is that South African filmmakers of all kinds, feature, documentary, meet in Cape Town at this function called Sitenge, and they come face to face with people who purchase and fund projects, programs for television, mostly for television, but also for cinema, from outside of South Africa. And these were predominantly, the representatives there were predominantly from Europe and Canada. There was an Australian representative there too. And on the one hand, while it was, of course, it was wonderful for these people to meet their possible funders face to face, but the picture that was drawn there was one of where the programmers are very limited in their interests. Reality productions were the prime concern of the BBC, which was absolutely shocking for me. I was told that there was really only one strand of the BBC left, that deals with documentary filmmaking. There were more sympathetic noises from Holland, and Holland has always been a good area for African filmmakers and Scandinavia. But even so, it was a long way from being in any way even as promising, oddly enough, as it was under apartheid, because under apartheid, underground filmmakers received funding. And it was kind of a tremendous shock for them after the ending of apartheid, when suddenly that funding no longer existed. And they had to look to other sources, mostly from within South Africa itself. Now, despite that, I think that they've done tremendously well. Enormously impressed by the quality of the documentary. I'm not talking about feature films, it's of the documentary, which I know something about, produced in South Africa at this time. Very, very impressive. But in common with documentary filmmakers everywhere, there's very little funding available. I always say, for example, that it was easier to get money for films against the Vietnam War during the Vietnam War period inside the United States itself in the late 60s, late 70s, and get it shown on television. It was much easier than it is to do something similar about the war in Iraq now in the United States. So there's been a tremendous degradation through control of the airwaves in the United States. And of course, there never has been tremendous interest in African subjects or African projects. So they're in really dire straits. My funding has always been, I don't know, I mean, I think maybe on five occasions during my entire life I ever had, and that may be an exaggeration, have I ever had complete funding for a documentary before I began to make it. But the process of looking for money is completely soul-destroying, and by the time you get the money, which may take several years, in fact, often you don't really have a desire to do that project anymore. It's not a happy circumstance to be a documentary filmmaker in these days.
And this morning I spoke to the MSU Library film bibliographer, Michael Rodriguez, and we talked about some of these issues, and he said that there was prospects of a cable channel to present the work of independent filmmakers, but even there, the whole apparatus of cable is heavily enmeshed with globalised interests. So we just had our local East Lansing Film Festival, where we saw a film from Benin in West Africa, made by an independent filmmaker who travelled from Germany back to his homeland, and quite fascinating film where he interviewed women in the northern part of the country, in Islamic parts, and I think it was a very, very interesting and well-made film. So I look around and I see some of the excellent feature films and documentaries coming out of Canada and South Africa and other parts of Africa. So I guess there's still hope in that regard. But I thank you for coming here and spending some time with us and making this contribution, if you like, to the history of film. So thank you, Peter Davis.
Oh, thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure.